Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a special bonus episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
1985 was an eventful year for Hollywood, seeing the releases of such timeless classics as The Goonies, Back to the Future, and The Breakfast Club. It also saw the release of this 80s flick, a medieval fantasy adventure telling the unforgettable tale of two lovers who are placed under a terrible curse. She transforms into a hawk during the day and he into a wolf by night. Together with the help of a crafty young thief, they must attempt to lift the curse for the sake of true love. So grab your sword, put on your armor, and mount your horse as Nicholas Pepin, Chad Shepard, and I discuss Lady Hawk from 1985 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
Within these woods lurks a mystery. Within this city waits revenge. Within this heart lies adventure. Whether he wants it or not.
I do not believe what I believe, Lord. These are magical, unexplainable matters, and I beg you not to make me a part of them.
Matthew Broderick in Lady Hawk, rated PG-13.
I'm Tim Williams, the mastermind behind the mic at the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Joining me on each epic episode is a guest co-host who's as crazy about 80s flicks as they are about wearing parachute pants and solving Rubik's Cubes. We're diving into nostalgic treasures we saw at the local theater, rented on VHS tapes, or discovered on cable TV. From blockbusters that make you say,
I feel the need for speed,
to hidden gems that'll have you screaming,
they're here.
It's a blast to relive these old memories and share our thoughts on what made these movies so special. We reminisce about our first time watch experiences, share our favorite scenes, and even discover fascinating behind the scenes tales about the cast and crew along the way. Haven't hit that subscribe button yet? What are you waiting for?
Come on, do it!
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. And hey, while you're at it, be a pal and drop us a written review along with a 5-star rating to tell us what you think about us.
Sportos, motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, they all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
Take a day off and come hang out with us on social media. Just search 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And don't forget to bookmark 80sflickflashback.com for more gnarly content.
Get out of town. I didn't know you did anything creative.
Want to crank it all the way up to 11? Become a supporter on buymeacoffee.com for only $5 a month.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Click the link in our episode show notes, and while you're there, soak up the extra trivia and fun stuff that didn't make it into today's show. Thanks again for tuning in. Now, let's get right into today's episode.
Welcome to the party, pal.
All right, welcome in, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us for this special bonus episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Jumping back into our forgotten 80s flick series that I started a few years ago, and excited about talking about some of the forgotten or maybe under the radar movies, or, you know, I guess just forgotten. I've said what it is. It's forgotten 80s flick or ones that are maybe not as popular, because I do, people are like, it's not forgotten. I haven't forgotten about it. Well, granted, you haven't forgotten about it, but it's not one that's, you know, talked about or heard about as much when people release their favorite movies from the 80s. These are usually movies that are not in that category. Not that they're terrible movies. They just don't have the same blockbuster status of others. And this is one of those that you would think would be more well known because it has Richard Donner as a director. You've got Matthew Broderick, who was very popular in the 80s. Michelle Pfeiffer, kind of before, or, you know, she wasn't the full breakout star at this point. And Rutger Hauer, who became a household name after Blade Runner. But it does kind of, I can kind of see why it has been forgotten, though. It is not the greatest fantasy adventure movie that I've ever seen, but we'll get into it. But first, let me introduce my wonderful co-host for this episode. You know him from Pop Culture Roulette and his many appearances here on the podcast. Please welcome Nicholas Pepin.
Let me take my glasses off so I can gaze upon now that the eclipse has passed.
There you go. Yeah, if I was really smart, I would have released this before, during the same time as the clips we just had, wouldn't I? Yeah, would have been. If I was a smart man, that's what I would have done. But alas, here we are. And joining us again, Chad Shepherd. How you doing, Chad?
I'm doing pretty good, Jim. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. Excellent. All right. Well, let's talk about Lady Hawk. So, when did you guys see Lady Hawk for the first time? I'll start with you, Chad.
I'm pretty sure it was either two places. And it's in the same building. I saw it in high school. Either during chorus, like if our teacher didn't want to teach us to sing, she put in a movie, and that was, or there was our chorus had a lock-in type thing. It was a rockathon. And I saw.
Oh, yeah. I remember those. Yeah.
And when you weren't rocking, you could go into like to the gym or something, or the cafeteria. And they had a movie TV set up, and that was the first time I saw Batman Returns, and we saw, I think it was all Lady Hawk there, too. So I'm pretty sure that's where I saw it. So high school, late 90s.
What about you, Nicholas?
Well, this is where I have to confess something. This is not the movie I thought I was signing up for when I jumped at it. I don't know what movie I thought I was signing up for when I saw this name. Because I was watching this movie a month or two ago for the first time. And then I realized as I'm watching it, this is the first time I've ever seen this. This is not the movie that because when you put out that list, I was like, oh yeah, I want to do that one. I don't know what movie I thought I signed up for.
Gotcha. Yeah, I'm not sure either. Because, I mean, there were a couple of like, you know, fantasy movies around, in the middle 80s, Willow, Legend, probably more well known than this one.
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what I thought this was, but it wasn't that. So a couple months ago was the first time I've ever saw this movie.
Okay. I'll confess, I think when I watched this a couple of months ago, it was the first time I had seen this movie. Like, I knew about it. I think I'd seen the trailer for it a couple of times. It was probably on cable, and I think it was one of those movies like I would catch like the middle of it, but I never saw the beginning. So I didn't really understand what was going on. So I never really watched it all the way through, because there were parts of it that I kind of vaguely remembered, but it wasn't one that I really wasn't big into these type of movies anyway in 85. This wasn't the type of movie I would have like gravitated towards anyway, but it is enjoyable. It has enjoyable moments. I think overall it's lacking some things, but it's overall enjoyable. So
no, I didn't hate it. I wasn't like I'm gonna text him and be like, I'm out.
I just finished watching it. I don't want to talk about it.
This isn't a Halloween 3 situation.
No. All right, so we know how long it's been since you watched it. So Chad, have you watched it again since high school? Or
it's funny, I was trying to catch up with it with for the podcast. Just you'd put out a list, and I was like, oh, I know that movie. So,
right.
And I've been trying to watch it. It's on Tubi. Mm-hmm. And now Tubi is doing this thing where it won't, unless you pay, you can't start where you can't stop and then come back to it. You have to start over again.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I kept getting interrupted. So I've watched the beginning of this movie several times. Like, I'm glad I like Alan Parsons Project.
Oh, yeah. We'll get into that, too. All right. So I'm just going to let everybody know that we lost Chad on the feed. He may come back in a little bit later. But so Nicholas and I are going to continue going forward. And if he jumps back in, we'll let him jump back in the conversation, just so you know where Chad went. Yeah. So I watched it for the very first time maybe 6 months ago, or like maybe it's been within the last year. And it was only because it was part of a group, like a, you know, mix and match on Vudu, which is now Fandango at Home. And I saw like a couple, like it was like this and Vision Quest and Creepshow were three 80s movies I knew I was going to cover and watch at some point. And I think it was like $3 for $10 or something like that. Oh, Chad's back. And so, so I bought the bundle, you know, I bought the three movies, and that's when I watched it. Cause I was like, I know I wanted to see it, but never seen it. So I watched it back then. So I watched it again today for the podcast. All right, well, let's jump into story origin and pre-production. And as I told the guys before we started recording, with this being a forgotten 80s flick, there's not a whole lot of backstory or a lot of notes about how this movie was made. So I have one short paragraph to read. So here we go. Richard Donner had attempted to get the film financed for a number of years and came close to making it twice, once in England and once in Czechoslovakia. He eventually got the project up at Warner's and Fox, where it was greenlit by Alan Ladd Jr. It did stall in pre-production for years before shooting finally commenced. One of the reasons for the delay was the arduous casting process. Actors signed on and then dropped out. Studios fought over celebrities to star, and locations took time to scout, and things just dragged on. So this was a long, I guess, passion project somewhat for Richard Donner, why it took so long to make. And I did look because this came out in 85, and as I mentioned in the intro, so did The Goonies. But this one actually came out like 2 months before Goonies. So he actually had not done the movie he had done before this one was The Toy in 82. So he had not made a movie for a couple of years. You know, The Toy did pretty well. It wasn't like a massive hit. And this one was not a hit. So I guess Goonies really kind of put him back on the map for sure as a bankable director.
Maybe they should have skipped it and gone right to Goonies.
Yeah, a better choice. Yes.
Yeah, I'm curious about what the script was, because I don't, you know, of course, like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of research there anyway, but I didn't see much about how the story, you know, it was screen written based on a story by somebody else, and what thing we'll get into in trivia, but I think like Warner Brothers marketed it like it was a true medieval tale or a long time fable that had been passed down from generation to generations, and come to find out that was all false. And the screenwriter like sued them for, you know, false advertising, that was not the case, but they basically paid him off and never rescinded their comment. So, but it is a complete work of fiction that we know of, but anyway, so it's a very interesting story. And we're talking about it, and surely if you listen to the podcast, hopefully you've seen it already, because we will spoil it. Not that there's a whole lot really to spoil in the movie, but it is an interesting story of this, you know, forbidden love. There's a bishop of the Catholic Church there, I guess, that curses them and makes one a hawk and one a wolf. So they can't be together in their physical form at the same time. So, and then how Matthew Broderick his character falls into the middle of the story to kind of help them figure it all out. So it's interesting.
There's not a lot to the story, like you said, and it does kind of feel like you're kind of picking it up in the middle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like you don't really, you know, they kind of just fill you in as they go along.
Yeah.
Like you're
it is a lot of exposition in the middle where, you know, when the one guy that's, you know, I guess healing Michelle Pfeiffer after being hit with the arrow, which she was the hawk, and him telling the story to Matthew Broderick Mouse.
It ultimately felt too long, but not long enough. Like it was like the pacing was just off. Like it just like, I think there's a different way to have told this story or a different way to have done it that would have made it more successful.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say it was a bad movie. I mean, it was still enjoyable. I'm glad I finally watched it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think you already hit the nail on the head. Like, I think I know why this is kind of a forgotten 80s movie.
I think, you know, we are, you know, Matthew Broderick's mouse character. We are him, and we follow mm-hmm. him.
Yeah.
But it would have been more interesting, like you said, it would have been interesting had we seen them together and then the curse and all mm-hmm. that beforehand.
Yeah.
Then maybe lose the, you know, Matthew Broderick could show up later, but.
Yeah, yeah.
But. Yeah, I do have an opinion about Matthew Broderick in this movie, too. But.
And now, these messages.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR.
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need, condensed, unfiltered, and raw, from three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay, sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday, available on all major podcast directories.
Let's jump into casting. The role of the pickpocket was actually offered to Sean Penn and then Dustin Hoffman before Donner decided to go with Matthew Broderick. Matthew Broderick as Philippe Gaston, the young thief known as the Mouse. Of course, his roles include the Golden Globe nominated portrayal of the title character in Ferris Bueller's Day Off in 86. So this came out before his probably most famous role. He was also the voice of the adult Simba in Disney's The Lion King in 1994. He was in the musical The Producers and its film adaptation. Other films that he starred in include War Games in 83, Glory in 89, The Freshman in 90, The Cable Guy in 96, Godzilla in 98, Election in 99, Inspector Gadget in 99, Tower Heist in 2011, and he was just recently in No Hard Feelings back in 2023. So, Chad, tell us your thoughts on Matthew Broderick.
I only see him as Ferris Bueller.
Yeah. Like, I mean, this is more like kind of character, now, for sure.
Now, I'm a huge fan of Election. That came out when I was, you know, my major movie-going days in college or in high school, and I saw it. I love that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, watching this, I'm like, he's so Ferris Bueller. Like, I couldn't see him as his character.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'm kind of where you are, but I don't think he's the Ferris Bueller, because Ferris Bueller is very fearless and very confident and sure of himself.
Yeah.
He's comical. Like, I know I think he's playing this character really for laughs. Like, there's a lot of one-liners and stuff like that. Yeah, but he's really the kind of there's a lot of his acting. And this is like, what's going on? You know, kind of frightened or trying to figure things out, which is different. That's not the kind of
role. Mouse-ish.
Yeah, exactly. That's not what I'm used to seeing him in. It right. reminds me a little bit more of like him in War Games, where, yeah, he was confident. But then once stuff gets in over his head, he kind of has that boyishy, like, what? I don't know. What do you mean? What's happening? I don't understand what's going on kind of thing. So it's an interesting role, and I think he does okay with it, but I think that's one of the reasons why I think the movie is kind of uneven, because he's almost there just for laughs.
Given that he was easily my favorite part of the movie, I didn't have a problem with him.
Yeah.
I try not to let actors get typecast just so that I can enjoy right. them and other right. stuff. I mean, I do have that problem with some actors. In fact, I think we'll talk about Rutger Hauer in a little bit here.
Right.
You know, I don't know. Like, I didn't have a problem with Matthew Broderick. Also, I mean, he was so young in this movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because this was only, a second or third movie? Like, this was, I mean, like you said, it was even before Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was early.
Yeah. He had done War Games in 82 or 83.
83.
And then I think this one, and then Ferris Bueller. Definitely still early in his career, which once again is probably why it's probably not as well known, because he wasn't the star that we know of him now when this came out. Like, if they would have held on to this one and waited until after Ferris Bueller came out, it probably would have been a bigger hit, kind of like the Teen Wolf and Back to the Future, where Teen Wolf was actually a film beforehand, but they waited until Back to the Future was released, knowing it was going to make him a big star. And then they released Teen Wolf, which became a huge hit, even though it was a far inferior movie compared to Back to the Future. But all right, well, let's talk about Rutger Hauer since we're moving down the list. He was the former captain of the guard who was hunted by the bishop. His career began in 1969 with a title role in the Dutch television series Floris and surged with his leading role in Turkish Delight in 1973. After gaining international recognition with movies such as Soldier of Orange in 77 and Spetters in 1980, he moved into American films, including Night Hawks in 81 with Sylvester Stallone and Billy Dee Williams, and then Blade Runner in 82. His performance in Blade Runner led to roles in The Osterman Weekend in 83, This Movie, Lady Hawk in 85, The Hitcher in 86, The Legend of Holy Drinker in 88, and Blind Fury in 89, among other films. From the 90s on, he moved into lower budget films and supporting roles and major films like Buffy the Vampire Slayer in 92, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind in 2002, Batman Begins in 2005, Sin City in 2005, and The Right in 2011. So you had some thoughts on Rutger Hauer, Nicholas?
Yeah, I think...
hot takes, here we go.
Well, I read in the trivia that Kurt Russell almost had his role.
Yeah, yeah, I was about to talk about that next, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think it would have been better if you had reversed and left him as the captain of guard and Kurt Russell as his character.
Yeah.
I think the dynamic would have been better between Kurt Russell and Michelle Pfeiffer, and I would have believed the captain of the guard more as him. I try not to let them get typecast, but I really had a hard time buying Rutger Hauer as like the leading man romantic interest for Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah, yeah. Which may go to why they didn't really show much of them together. Like, if the chemistry's not there, you know, to build upon at the beginning, we don't show that part. You know, they just kind of see them separated. But yeah, so Kurt Russell was originally cast in the Rutger Hauer role, and Rutger Hauer was the captain of the guard. But Hauer actually didn't want to do the guard because he didn't want to get typecast as a villain after playing the villain in Blade Runner. So he told Richard Donner, hey, if anything changes, I'd rather have the lead instead. And so basically, like, days before filming began, Russell dropped out because I think he was finishing up with, he was still doing some stuff with The Thing, and then he was also filming Silkwood at the same time. So then Rutger got the call to come and take the spot. But he also said after this movie, he didn't want to play a leading man anymore. So that's why he did more like, supporting roles. But I think Kurt Russell would have been a better choice for the lead.
Yeah, I wonder if it would have been a forgotten 80s flick had those roles been reversed, or had Kurt Russell stayed in it. You know.
Yeah, even though we talk about The Thing, that was, you know, that didn't become a hit until much later. So
yeah,
he was struggling there in the 80s too, but it may be more memorable. Even the movies that didn't do well are still memorable because Kurt Russell was in them.
True, true.
All right, moving on to Michelle Pfeiffer as Isabeau of Anjou. I'm going to mess up all these names, who's hunted by the bishop. Pfeiffer began her acting career with minor television and film appearances, and had her first leading role in the critically and commercially unsuccessful Grease 2 in 1982. Her breakout role as Elvira in Scarface was in 1983 that built her mainstream success, which grew with performances in The Witches of Eastwick in 87 and Tequila Sunrise in 88 with Kurt Russell. Pfeiffer received her first of six consecutive Golden Globe Award nominations for Married to the Mob in 88. Her performances in Dangerous Liaisons in 88 and Fabulous Baker Boys in 89 earned her two consecutive Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actress and Best Actress, respectively, winning a Golden Globe Award for the latter. In 1990, she starred in The Russia House, Frankie and Johnny in 1991. In 92, she played Catwoman in Batman Returns and received her third Academy Award nomination for Love Field, which was succeeded by performances in The Age of Innocence in 93, Wolf in 94. She also produced several own features for her company Via Rosa Productions, including Dangerous Minds in 95. Focusing on her family, she acted sporadically throughout the 2000s, appearing in What Lies Beneath in 2000, White Oleander in 2002, Hairspray and Stardust, both in 2007. She sent in an audition tape for the part in Lady Hawk, despite reservations about the fantasy genre. She had been sent part of the script to read containing a scene between Isabeau and Gaston, later played by Matthew Broderick. Pfeiffer read the part and enlisted the aid of a friend of hers to read for the part of Gaston. The friend was a still unknown actor at the time named Kevin Costner.
Oh, just that guy. Little known actor. Even today, just barely known.
I wonder whatever happened to him.
Yeah, I don't know. So any thoughts on Michelle Pfeiffer?
I mean, they didn't really give her a lot to do in this movie.
No.
No problems with her. I mean, you just listed off a really impressive, you know, body of work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, clearly she knows what she's doing.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have put just about any female of that age in this movie and gotten pretty much the same performance out of her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the script for her role was pretty light.
Yeah. Yeah. What about you, Chad?
She will always be my Catwoman.
Right. Yeah,
And it's funny. I was thinking about if I did see this movie the same time I saw Batman Returns. So I saw two Michelle Pfeiffer movies mm-hmm. in a row. So
mm-hmm.
I thought she's great. Yeah, Grease 2 is a little underwhelming compared to the first one.
Yeah. Grease 2 is a movie that I saw way too many times on cable as a kid. My sister was obsessed with it, so it was always on. Michelle Pfeiffer is one of those actresses, like, I don't think she's a terrible actress, but she's not. I've never been one of my favorite actresses of the 80s or even the 90s. Even though I mentioned a lot of those movies, I don't think I've seen a lot of the movies that she was in the 90s. I know I saw Dangerous Minds. I think I saw Wolf. I didn't see Age of Innocence. I didn't see Dangerous Liaisons. I didn't see Fabulous Baker Boys. I've seen Married to the Mob. I've started The Witches of Eastwick like three times and never been able to finish it. She's a decent actress, but she's never been one of my, you know, top favorite actresses that I'm, you know, make sure like, oh, Michelle Pfeiffer's in it. I got to go see it. Like, she's not one of those actresses for me. Nothing against her. Just haven't been that big of a fan of hers, but I agree with you, Nicholas. She doesn't really have a whole lot to do in this besides somewhat transform between the hawk and the human.
Is Wolf the one with her and Jack Nicholson?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've only seen that on TBS, and TBS edits the fool out of it. And like, I've never, it edits so bad. It doesn't even make sense. And I'm like, every time I watch it,
no,
I have no idea what this is about.
It the uncut version doesn't make a lot of sense.
It doesn't make sense. Okay.
No. Yeah, I remember some friends of mine, we rented it and watched it, and we were like, this movie doesn't make any sense. It was just like, yeah, it's not very good. All right, so moving down the line, we've got Leo McKern as Imperius, the old monk living in the ruined castle, an Australian actor who appeared in numerous British, Australian, American television programs and films. And in more than 200 stage roles, his notable roles include Clang in Help in 1965. He was in A Man for All Seasons in 66, Ryan's Daughter in 1970, Candle Shoe in 77. He was in The Blue Lagoon in 1980 and The French Lieutenant's Woman in 1981. The role that made him a household name as an actor was when he played in the British television series Rumpole of the Bailey, which, you know, I have every episode on DVD. Just kidding. He also portrayed Carl Bugenhagen in the first and second installments of the Omen series and number two in the TV series The Prisoner. So he seemed to be one of those that guys until I really read his filmography and I was like, no, I really haven't seen anything that he's in. So maybe just
that's exactly what I thought too.
Yeah.
I definitely remember him from Blue Lagoon.
Okay.
Like the old man who got the kids on the island and then eventually died. Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie, but it's been a long time since I've seen that one. But one person I did recognize was John Wood as the bishop who was obsessed with killing them. From 83 to 86, he acted in a variety of Hollywood films, most notably War Games in 83. Right. He played Faulkner, which is where I recognized him from. He was also in The Purple Rose of Cairo in 84 and Jumpin' Jack Flash in 86. He's mainly a stage actor, very much within the Shakespeare circuit. But yeah, I recognize him immediately as Falcon from War Games. Now, here's my hot take. The bishop is probably my least favorite part of this movie because there's no backstory. There's nothing like he's not a good villain. Like, you know, for a great story, you've got to have a great villain. And I just felt like the villain wasn't there. Like there wasn't enough of him to understand why he was having this weird dream when she's getting the arrow pulled out of her. Like there was just things just didn't seem to connect for me, but he just seemed like we need a bad guy, make him the bishop and just act weird. So that's just kind of the way he came across to me.
Yeah. I mean, like he had a whole line about like, how am I supposed to collect taxes if there's nothing left to tax? Like, it was just like, I don't know. You're right. It didn't seem like he was just bad to be bad, but they didn't really. Yeah, they just didn't really have much to do. Same kind of like with Michelle Pfeiffer. Like he just, they just kind of forgot to write that part of it.
Yeah, they didn't flesh it out enough. The characters weren't fleshed out enough for me.
If they had a better beginning, like we were talking about, if you actually saw the stuff, you would have known the connection. You would have known why he's acting the way he is.
Yeah. So. Even if it was in somewhat of like a montage. And it was funny because when the movie first started, because it had been a couple months since I watched it, I was expecting to read some kind of text on the screen, like in the year, you know, just something to kind of tell you what's kind of setting up the story. And it's nothing. It's the Alan Parsons soundtrack over credits, opening credits for the first 2 minutes, the eye of the bird. So the last person we'll mention is who I forgot was in this until he popped up, Alfred Molina. Yeah. These are the wolf trapper who serves the bishop. Of course, we know him from Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, which was his film debut. He's been in several movies, including Boogie Nights in 97, Chocolat in 2000, Luther in 2003, The Da Vinci Code in 2006. He voiced characters in Rango in 2011, Monsters University 2013. He's also known, probably best known now for his portrayal as Doc Ock in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2. And of course, the most recent Spider-Man No Way Home in 2021.
Yeah, he was great in that.
And this was almost a blink and you miss him cameo.
Yeah, yeah. There he is. And man, he's dead from putting his head in a bear trap.
And he looked similar, but different enough where I'm like, who is that? So I had to look it up. Yeah. I'm like, oh.
No. Okay. I recognize him immediately. He looks more like he did back, you know, whenever he pops up on Raiders of the Lost Ark, I'm like, oh yeah, this is his first movie because he looks very different, but he's kind of similar to that. Yeah, similar to that look in this one for sure. All right, anybody else in the cast we want to mention, or I think I covered the highlights?
I mean, I think you covered the entire cast.
Yeah, the other ones didn't have much to do, so.
Just the guys in the red outfits who
kept
chasing them, the guards.
All right, let's talk iconic scenes, favorite scenes. Does this movie have an iconic scene? I know we're kind of...
Not that I could think of. I knew that question was coming, and I was like, yep, no.
No.
Yeah, I knew it was coming today when I was watching, and I was like, there's really nothing that stands out, you know. Maybe the scene where he, you know, when he kills the bishop at the end with the sword going through him in the chair, I thought was pretty cool. And as a kid, that probably would have been the scene that if there was a scene that I watched as a kid, like I might have not seen the beginning, but I knew that part was coming up and I watched till that part. Because I think the end is what I remembered the most from the movie. Like once they get in there and they're doing their little duel back and forth, I was like, I kind of remember seeing this as a kid, but. So any favorite scenes that you really liked or scenes at least we want to talk about?
I enjoyed the monologues with Matthew Broderick Mouse when he was talking to God, like,
dear
Lord, you help me get out of here. I'll never do this again.
Yeah.
And then immediately goes and starts pickpocketing. And he's like, well, you understand.
You know me.
Right.
You know, I'm weak. Like,
right. Right.
I mean he was the most enjoyable part of the movie for me.
Yeah.
And so anytime he was doing his little monologue, you know, that was the enjoyable part for me. Those were my favorite scenes.
Yeah, I think Chad was right. Like he's really the character for the audience to connect the most with, like trying to piece the story together and understand what's happening. So he is kind of the lead that you kind of follow or you care the most. Like he was the character I cared the most about in the movie. Like the love between the two of them wasn't that compelling to me, you know, between Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer. The villain was pretty much non-existent, so I didn't really care about that. But watching him kind of go through the journey was the most enjoyable part of the movie for sure.
That's why we didn't get the whole backstory, is because we showed up when he did.
Mm-hmm.
When he was breaking out of the prison in the beginning.
It's not necessarily a favorite scene, but we do have to discuss it. It's a little weird. There's one line in the movie, early in the movie, that is odd.
Okay.
He's escaping out of the mud.
Oh, yes. I know what you're talking about.
Oh.
So I'm going to try to put it delicately because I know this is not my podcast. So,
I mean, you could say it. You'd say it verbatim. I don't think it's going to break any rules.
He said it. It's not unlike escaping the mother's womb.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and then he says something about what a memory.
Yeah, what a memory. Like, yeah, that's such a weird line.
It's like, wait, what? First off, you remember that? Secondly, secondly, like, that's where you went to when you were getting out of a tight spot? Like, that's Yeah. It was a very odd line.
Once again, comic relief, but sometimes all the jokes don't land for sure. But yeah, when I heard that line today, I was like, what? Did he just say that? And they cut away from it very quickly. So it's almost like they were like, should we keep it, not keep it? Just make it quick, you know, just move along.
Yeah, I did read that, if you can hear, I didn't actually hear it myself, but I read that right when he said that, you can hear like, I guess Donner saying cut. Mm-hmm. You can hear it as.
Yeah, like in the distance.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, I read that too. I didn't go back and watch that scene to see if it was there, but it could have been. Like, I wonder if that was an ad lib of Broderick that he just kind of threw in there.
Yeah, one of the scenes that I liked was the scene where they were actually transforming in front of each other. Like,
okay,
the,
yeah, yeah.
I can't remember if it was which way it was, but it was. Oh, it was her looking at the wolf, and then they were both fading in. You know, mm-hmm. And it wasn't the best CGI or whatever they were using at the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's not top notch special effects, that's for sure.
But it worked for what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a good scene. And the scene where she was falling, like Matthew Broderick grabbed her, and then she let go, and then as she was falling, the sun came up and she turned into the hawk.
Mm-hmm.
That was a good scene.
I mean, like I said, the story itself is interesting, and I just wish it was executed a little bit better. And that's hard for me to say because I'm a big fan of Donner. Like, I think Donner's a great director. I don't know if it just was budget or, you know, what he had to work with. He just had to make it as good as he could, which is possible because, like I said, I'm sure he wasn't given a whole lot of money for the movie because he hadn't had a big hit in a while. It's possible he couldn't do a lot that he wanted to do due to money reasons.
And not everything that you do is going to work. Sometimes there's very few directors who hit it out of the park every time they step
very
up.
True.
Yeah. Cause before this movie, I forget which one you were talking about, but
the toy
was okay. Well, mm-hmm. then before that was, he was supposed Superman. To be Superman too.
Right. Yeah.
And then he got fired from it.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably didn't trust him as much as they would have had would have stayed and actually done part two Superman.
Yeah. They had been working, trying to get it made for several years and kept having issues. So it might've just been like, look, if you want to make it, just make it. And, you know, we'll have to figure everything out as we go. All right. Any other scenes we want to talk about before I jump into trivia?
Is any of your trivia about the score? Or are we just going to not talk about
that? I'm going to talk about it. You want to talk about that now? We'll jump into that. I can do that first.
Let's talk about the score.
Okay. You want me to read my blurb about it and then you can
read your blurb about it.
So Andrew Powell composed the score and it was produced by Alan Parsons. Richard Donner stated that he was listening to the Alan Parsons project, on which Powell collaborated while scouting for locations and became unable to separate his visual ideas from the music. Powell combined traditional orchestral music with Gregorian chant with contemporary progressive rock infused material. At the time, it was part of a trend among 1980s fantasy films of abandoning the lush orchestral scores of composers such as John Williams, James Horner, and Jerry Goldsmith in favor of a modern pop rock sound. The soundtrack has met some criticism, with some saying the synthesizer-laden track is unsuitable for a medieval-themed movie, while others were more critical, with one reviewer calling it the cream of the crop when it comes to atrocious scores. And another saying it sounded like an exercise video that got played on top of a low-budget 80s sitcom. It has also been placed at the top of a list of worst movie sound scores and appears on three other lists of bad movie music. Another commentator calls it one of the most widely mocked soundtracks in the history of film. End quote.
Yeah, they're not too far off.
I was going to say, are you point or counterpoint on this one, Nicholas?
No, it really doesn't fit at all.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I mean, it's hard to get through it sometimes.
Like, just because you were listening to Alan Parsons Project when you were scouting it and you couldn't take the two away from each other,
right?
Doesn't mean it should have happened, because it really, I mean, it was so jarring. And anytime it happened, it would just immediately take me out of the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, those opening credits were awful. They were just bad. I mean, it doesn't help that I'm not a big fan of Alan Parsons Project to begin with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, that 80s synth when you're trying to watch a sword and shield movie, you know, like, it really took me out of it. It didn't work. Like, I know, what was that movie with Heath Ledger? A Knight's Tale,
where they did like the modern.
Where, yeah, but that worked. Yeah.
Right.
Like, that made, you know, they worked it into the movie. So, like, that kind of, it didn't take it away as much. Mm-hmm. Where this one, it really, it just, it was not. Yeah.
Your thoughts, Chad, before I chime in?
Nicholas, you ignorant slut. No. Counterpoint. Point.
Yeah, anyway. I knew where you were going. Oh, okay. 70s. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I shouldn't have said that.
No, 70s, 80s.
No,
somewhere in there.
I liked it. I thought it was interesting. I mean, it wasn't your typical, you know, like you said, John Williams or you know, any of the other guys with the orchestral stuff. But I like the Alan Parsons Project. I mean, I can only name a couple of songs, but I like them.
I know the name. I couldn't tell you any songs that they do. Like, I've heard of the Alan Parsons Project, but yeah.
One of their most popular one is Eye in the Sky.
Okay.
And then they did the music for the Bulls during Jordan.
Oh, is that okay.
Yeah, their big theme song as they come in. Yeah. That was Alan Parsons Project too.
Gotcha.
So
the opening credits are hard to get through with the music because there's really not much. You're just watching credits, so there's not, it's not putting you in any kind of, like, it's not setting up the movie well for me. And there are scenes where when it starts playing, I'm just like, I just kind of shake my head. I mean, I get over it pretty quick. But I feel like it dates the movie more than it should. Like, it, you know, with it being a, like you said, a medieval movie, thinking, oh, they're going to watch this again in 10 years. You want it to be more for the, you know, the period that it's set in, not necessarily, you know, what was popular at the time, but you know, it was a choice. He made a choice, whether it was the right choice or not, but maybe that, you know, it unfortunately, that seems to be what it's most remembered for, is the soundtrack, good or bad, mostly bad.
I don't know if I'd go quite as far as to say it's like the worst soundtrack of all time.
No,
but it's definitely not the best. It's it's definitely not good, you know.
Right. It's interesting. And there was another movie that was like that too, where it's like, the music just didn't fit. Like, you could tell they were trying to do something different, and it seemed like everything clashed. It took you out of the moment. And that's what happened with this one. Like, there are certain scenes where, like, I wanted to be engaged in like a chase scene or whatever. And then as soon as the music started, I'm like, oh, okay, it's just the music. And it kind of takes you out of the moment for a second instead of elevating the moment, or, you know, making you connect even deeper to the music. It seemed to like make me detach more so than become more engaged, but teach his own.
There was the scene where I can't remember. I don't know if it was right when they were leaving the castle or if it was the scene after he told Rutger Hauer that, oh, we just changed clothes in the building together. He said, you did? He's like, no, I didn't. I wasn't there. He said, you left her alone? Like,
right.
No,
right.
We did. And then they're like, okay, let's leave. And then when they were leaving, it came on like very loudly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, well, that was abrupt.
Yeah.
Like, it should have been like, you know, something soft and, you know, we're going to a next scene. It's like just jumped into it. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It was kind of jarring in some spots. It's like, okay, you could have tapered it down just a little bit. But
yeah.
All right. Well, let's jump into some of the scenes and trivia. One of the first, we've kind of talked about this scene as well, but some of the behind the scenes, one of the first major set pieces in Lady Hawk depicts Gaston's daring escape from prison, which required actor Matthew Broderick to swim in a castle moat, emerging dramatically from the water and run on foot across a wintry Italian countryside. According to Broderick, when he read the script, he thought it sounded like a great scene. Little did he know at the time that Gaston burst from the water actually meant Gaston burst from the waters for 2 hours straight. The reality of filmmaking is often slow and repetitive. In this case, poor Broderick spent hours fully submerged in icy waters of the moat, only then to spend 2 days filming the sequence of a sopping wet Gaston running through wintry landscapes. If he looks freezing on screen, that's only because the actor was freezing in real life. Now, I did read something that, you know, Donner really wants to take care of his actors, and like, they gave him like a wetsuit to wear underneath his clothes to help keep him somewhat warm, which they could use for the wide shots. But he couldn't wear them for any of the close-ups. So there were times where he really was freezing because he was wet and like really cold temperatures. So another fun story. Rutger Hauer is an accomplished equestrian. He spent much of his youth riding horses, even at the competitive level. Matthew Broderick, on the other hand, was not so confident. In fact, he had never ridden a horse before in his life. There's a scene where Hauer's character sends Broderick out alone on his horse. They plan to put Broderick on the horse and then cut before sending it riding off, but Hauer had other more impious ideas. Ever a prankster and a firm believer in baptism by fire, apparently he slapped the horse's rear. The animal took off on a tremendous gallop with Broderick barely hanging on. Crew members were sent out in jeeps to track them down and eventually found both horse and rider half a mile away.
Wow. So. You're going to get good at riding a horse and you're going to get good fast.
Right, right. There wasn't a whole lot of trivia, so here's my last little thing here. So the scene at the end in which Navarre embraces and holds Isabeau over his head while spinning around was Rutger Hauer's idea, thinking it would bring more emotion to the scene. Director Richard Donner liked the idea and included it into the film. Whether it worked or not, I don't know. It was kind of interesting how he just kind of picks her up and the sun's behind them and, you know, the music, the Alan Parsons music is blaring in the background. It was, yeah. I'll tell you one thing it made me think of at that point. This movie is about to be over. And it was. That was the end. I knew the credits were coming soon.
And now these messages.
Hey there, fellow 80s movie aficionados. Are you ready to embark on a nostalgia-filled journey to the greatest era of cinema? Then look no further than the Retro Life for You 80s Movie Podcast. Join us every week as we rewind the VHS tapes, dust off those Betamax classics, and dive headfirst into the neon-soaked, totally tubular world of the 1980s movies. From the Brat Pack to action heroes, we've got it all covered. Breakfast Club, Ghostbusters, E.T. and Indiana Jones, and more. It's like a trip in Doc Brown's time machine, but without the DeLorean. So whether you're a diehard 80s film buff or just curious about the cinematic gems of the past, Retro Life for You is your ticket to the ultimate movie time warp. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Retro Life for You. And we can be found anywhere you listen to your podcast, as well as on our website, www.retrolife4u.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
All right, Lady Hawk was released in North American theaters on April 12th, 1985, debuting at number 4 at the box office. The Stephen King adaptation Cat's Eye barely beat it for the number 3 slot, only by like $1,000. It was that close. Police Academy 2, their first assignment, remained at the top spot for the third straight week, while Mask remained in the second spot after 6 weeks in theaters. So Mask is another, like, I would say is a forgotten 80s movie because you can't find it anywhere to stream. But that's a movie that I loved as a kid with Cher, based on a true story. If you've never seen it.
It's, Sam Elliott.
Yeah. Yeah, Sam Elliott. Yep, exactly. Yep. So.
And
I remember it being a very good movie. Oh, and Eric Stoltz was the...
I wonder if he left Back to the Future to go make that movie since it came out that same time.
I don't remember. Oh. I think he was coming... I don't remember. So... All right, Rotten Tomatoes has it at 67% on the tomato meter and 74% audience score. This was the shocking one for me. IMDb, 6.9 out of 10 with viewers and a 64 on Metacritic. So the critics, I guess, kind of like this movie because 69 on Metacritic is pretty high because I'm used to stuff being in like the 30s and 20s.
Yeah. So Metacritic does hate things.
I don't think it's as high enough for a 74 for me. I think 67 feels about right for me for the tomato in the tomato meter. What about you guys?
I gave it a 6 on IMDb.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's good, but it's not great.
Mm-hmm.
It's not terrible. Like, you know, like it might be a few years before I try to watch it again.
Yeah. Yeah. This will be one of those that I'll kind of have on in the background probably just to have something on, but I'm probably not going to pay that much attention to it. It doesn't really hold my attention as well as I want it to, I don't think. What about you, Chad?
Yeah, I probably won't watch it unless somebody says, hey, would you like to do this movie on a podcast?
You'll probably say, no, I've already done that one.
No, I've already done that one, yeah.
All right.
See this episode.
Exactly. Send them here. So
that's right.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast today. Nicholas, what you got going on with Pop Culture Roulette? Anything special happening in the next couple of weeks?
We just did an episode. We just did a bracket on stoner movies.
For 420, I see what you do there.
Yeah. So it was fun doing a stoner movie bracket while not being a stoner at all myself.
Yeah. Makes it interesting, I'm sure.
Yeah. So... but other than that, just more brackets and more pop culture nonsense.
Very cool. Very cool. Chad, you still being an audience member for Family Feud, or you moved to other game shows yet?
No, they moved. They moved studios. They went to Tyler Perry's studio up in Atlanta.
Okay.
And they changed the way they do the audition. So I have not been emailed at all. They're almost done. Mm. I think next month is the last of the thing. So. I haven't got one email, so.
Okay.
Quick plug. I was on Chris Adams' Retro Life for You podcast a couple of episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about
War Games.
War Games, yeah. Yeah. So when we're talking about
Matthew Broderick.
John Wood, yeah.
Yeah.
So we had fun doing that.
Way to keep it connected. Good job, Chad.
Yeah, hey, there you go. So that was fun, and I think you and I are going to be doing one coming up.
I think so. I've started planning for the rest of the year. So I'm having to remember what I have coming up in the next couple of weeks. Cause I've already focused on I've planned July, August, September, all that kind of stuff. So my brain has kind of moved that way, but we got some good episodes still coming up, but that's a wrap on today's episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. If you had as much fun as we did, please show us some love with an awesome review and a shiny 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and spread the word to all your 80s flick loving pals. Got questions or just want to chat about your favorite flicks? You can reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you're feeling super cool, why not support the show over at buymeacoffee.com? Even as little as $5 a month makes a big difference. Plus, you can totally rock some killer 80s flick flashback gear and original designs by checking out our online store at 80sflickflashback.com and tpublic.com for all the nostalgic swag you could ever want. All right, everybody, thanks again for tuning in. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Sir, the truth is, I talk to God all the time, and no offense, but he never mentioned you.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.